This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I have to thank Dr. Moore for that wonderful lead-in. These are my disclosures in the area of carotid intervention. I actually was a participant in the CREST trial, both as a surgeon and as an interventionalist, and have been involved in many of the ongoing, both transfemoral distal embolic protection as well as proximal occlusion flow reversal trials. So I'm excited to bring you some information. As has been previously elaborated upon, we know that although the results for both the CAS and the endarterectomy arms for the CREST trial were arguably some of the best that we've ever seen in prospective trials, there's a lot of debate about how you might interpret this data, depending on which side of the argument you find yourself. Certainly we know that as surgeons that carotid endarterectomy has provided durable and long-standing results. We know that on the area of stroke, both major and minor stroke, we certainly see a benefit. But nevertheless, I don't think we can ignore the concerns from our cardiology colleagues about myocardial infarction, particularly significant MI, which may have some impact on long-term survival. I think we also have to recognize that there are the potential for local complications, both wound complications and cranial nerve injury. And we do a fairly poor job, I think, of documenting that. And in fact, in our institution, we've gone to sort of an independent review to try to put this issue to rest, where every patient undergoing carotid intervention, be it endarterectomy or stenting, is evaluated by an independent NIH stroke scale certified, usually a fellow or nurse, both pre, post, and 30 days afterwards to try to address some of these concerns. We also know that with transfemoral CAS, as Dr. Moore very nicely pointed out, the incidence of periprocedural event rates is nearly double that as seen in CEA. And we know that for that over 75 group, that higher risk group, the events are almost double, maybe even triple in some series. However, if you look at sort of this is other data from CREST, we know that most of those events are at the time or immediately periprocedurally, and once you get to a week or 2 weeks or a month out, those event rates are fairly comparable. So again, if we can address the issue at the time of the intervention, perhaps we have a way of further improving those results. Once again, I think it's hard to argue with brilliant vascular surgeons. Juan Perotti has been with us for a long time and involved in endovascular AAA repair. He's also thought about this issue and, as many of you are aware, came up with the Perotti anti-embolization system subsequently purchased by W.L. Gore. I was actually part of that pivotal trial that Dan Clare was the national PI on, looking at CAS with proximal occlusion flow reversal. And in this system, it was a fairly cumbersome system delivered through a 9-French sheath. It's really a big system that you're getting through the arch into the common carotid with an occlusion balloon, as you can see here, placed in the common carotid, a separate occlusion balloon in the external to prevent reversal of flow. But with that system in place, what we found was the event rates in symptomatic and asymptomatic patients and in octogenarians and non-octogenarians was no different between the groups. And I think that's very important. Similarly, in the MoMA study, which is a device that Medtronic currently owns, very similar results. No difference in the symptomatic versus asymptomatic groups, and no difference when you look at those under and over the age of 75, or even in this group, symptomatics over the age of 75, arguably the highest risk group. The problem is you have to get these big, bulky, cumbersome systems through the arch in place and working to get that benefit. And that's where part of the problem is, because we know that the risk of embolization doesn't just occur at the time of the balloon, but it's when you're putting a catheter in the arch, doing your angiogram, getting up there, wire exchange, sheath exchange. The other concern I have, and this has been brought up by some of our colleagues in the neurology literature, is we know that there are microembolic events that occur at CAS and certainly at the time of even CEA. And there was some interesting data that was brought to our attention initially by people like Samira McDonald, who's an interventional radiologist in the UK, looking at the ICSS subset data, where a certain proportion of those patients in that carotid stent trial also had diffusion-weighted MR imaging. And the point of this is we know there are new microembolic events. We're not certain of the significance. In other words, this does not necessarily correlate with a major stroke, although there is some data to suggest that this may have a long-term impact on cognitive function and is certainly part of the CREST-2 trial. I know there is talk about including both DWMR and neurocognitive psych testing to try and evaluate and look at the significance of this. Let me put it to you this way. If you were going to have a carotid intervention, be it stent or surgery, and I told you I could cut in half or maybe by a third the number of new bright lesions that we see in your brain on MRI, would you say it's a good thing or a bad thing? When I talk to my cardiology colleagues, oh, it doesn't matter. It's just, you know, a bunch of imaging stuff. Maybe they don't need those extra brain cells, but I can tell you from a surgical standpoint, I certainly still do. So when we look at transfemoral casts, the incidence of new DWMR lesions is as high as, you know, 80 or 70% higher. Certainly when we get down to CEA, we get a very reasonable number. And if by using a different technique, direct carotid access with institutional flow reversal, we can decrease the number of these new hits and decrease the neurologic event rates, that would be a good thing. And perhaps a hybrid procedure, something that we've talked about and will continue to talk about over the next several days at this course, is a solution. I think that's something that we as the vascular surgery community can certainly help evaluate. This is just a summation of series of transcervical casts. This basically came out of individuals practicing in the community who thought this concept makes sense. If I can do a small either percutaneous or small incision in the neck, gain access to the common carotid artery right above the clavicle, put in a sheath, institute flow occlusion and flow reversal, aspirating back, perhaps our neurologic event rates could be decreased. In fact, this is where the commercialization of this concept came up. There is a company I'll tell you about in a moment, Silk Road, that is performing a prospective randomized trial, again, here in the U.S. I'm sorry, not randomized, but a prospective trial. And it was based on data like this. So here is the Michi neuroprotective system. And as I mentioned earlier, I am involved, along with my partner, Dr. Richard Cambria, as the national co-principal investigators. Dr. Moore at UCLA and his colleagues are one of our sites, as well as close to 20 other sites across the United States. It does follow the principle of direct carotid access at the moment through a small supraclavicular incision. You isolate the common carotid artery. We do apply Rommel tourniquet, FLIR temporary flow occlusion, and this has enough capacity that you can have flow reversal through a filtered system with reinstallation of blood into the venous system. This was the article published in the Journal of Vascular Surgery. Doctors Pinter and Kolvenbach were the two senior surgeons involved with this process. But looking at the initial safety and feasibility, as Dr. Schneider mentioned yesterday, most of the trials, at least for the initial in-human studies, are performed outside the U.S. But again, I would argue that much of the preliminary data was developed by vascular surgeons here in the United States, people like Enrique Criado, who's currently up at the University of Michigan, who started doing these procedures on patients they considered to be high risk for other interventions, and they're really the ones who pioneered this technique initially. So in the proof study, there was a prospective single-arm feasibility study, again performed all in Germany by Drs. Kolvenbach and Pinter. They had no events, fortunately. They did have one minor stroke on the contralateral side in a patient 2 to 3 days after the initial event. And interestingly, they also performed a DWI sub-study in 55 of the patients and found that the new lesion rate was very, very comparable, 19.6%, comparable to that from what we've seen in the ICSS study, and I think further studies like this will be important to follow up on. Here's sort of a magnified view just to get you a sense of what we're talking about. Essentially a small supraclavicular incision with a Rommel tourniquet. This is a fairly large bore sheath system with basically a stopper so that it allows you to only insert about 2.5 centimeters of the sheath system into the common carotid artery. You have this in place with flow reversal into the contralateral common femoral vein. We have everything set up on the back table in terms of a balloon, a stent, and essentially, once this cutdown has been performed, the patients are awake, so they're able to speak with you, and you can evaluate their neurologic status. The time once you get facile with this procedure to perform the carotid stent part of the intervention is somewhere in the order of 5 to 7 minutes. So flow reversal time of 5 to 7 minutes, which arguably is a little bit longer than it takes you to put a shunt in, but not that much longer. And certainly for critical stenosis, this certainly seems like a very interesting way to go. Here's some of the current clinical trials. There was the PROOF study, which you've seen the publications on. Dr. McDonald in the UK is performing her own single-center registry. There is a post-market trial, the Tesla trial, going on in the EU currently. And the Roadster trial is the U.S. pivotal IDE trial, again, which we are currently involved with here in the U.S. For the moment, it is looking at high surgical risk patients. So we certainly have done this on patients with previous radiation or scar tissue. Obviously, you have to have a judgment there in terms of still performing a small supraclavicular cutdown, high bifurcations, previous endarterectomy. And then, interestingly, as was pointed out, one of the criterion, because this is based on some of the earlier studies, is actually age over the age of 75. So we will include those quote-unquote high-risk patients who I actually think are probably high-risk for CAS. So I think it'll actually be a very important study in terms of looking at that data. We're looking for 140 patients, although because it is a new technique, we are having roll-in patients at each site. So I predict the number of patients we'll actually have in the study will be double that. It'll be closer to 280 or 300 because we'll allow roll-ins per site. Again, probably about 20 sites. This is just one example of a patient with, as we can see, I don't think anybody would argue this is a pretty critical stenosis with peak systolics close to over 400, end diastolic close to 200 with a lot of spectral broadening. I think another key component is we are evaluating patients both with duplex beforehand because we don't want to be entering diseased, calcified, common carotid arteries down at the bifurcation. And I'll add my own two cents into the duplex debate. I certainly think while we still perform the majority of our endarterectomies at the MGH under duplex alone, if I'm going to consider a patient for CAS, I'm almost always getting some sort of axial imaging study, again, to look at the arch, to look at tortuosity, to look at calcification, because I think our margin for error and stroke is very, very low, and that gives us the most information. Certainly, I do not routinely perform diagnostic angiography. I think that's just a recipe for disaster in terms of embolic events. So here's the intra-arterial angiogram. We're careful about the positioning. As you can see, a very, very tight stenosis here. I think we slipped by. Here's a stent in place. And interestingly, with this system, because I'm more interested in making sure that we're doing this quickly, minimizing the flow reversal time, I'm actually not necessarily pre-dilated patients if I can get my stent right across the stenosis. And with the aspiration system, we know that every time you manipulate, whether you're crossing, pre-dilating, post-dilating, you're at risk of liberating embolic debris. We leave the flow reversal on high the entire time and just try to do the procedure as quickly but as accurately as possible. So here's the completion angiogram, both in the neck and intracranial. And then post-study, we always perform a completion duplex to look both at the stent and, importantly, at the access site to make sure that we're not creating a flap or a dissection or a problem. This is the type of debris that you can retrieve. This is from one of our early cases with the filter debris, fairly impressive. These patients can be treated under local anesthesia. Our average procedure time is close to an hour, and I have a feeling as we become more facile, that will drop. Flow reversal time anywhere from 6 to 11 minutes. There are currently 11 sites in the U.S. approved with IRB approval, 2 sites in the EU. The roll-in patients, as I had mentioned, and to date, we have about 14 roll-in patients and 7 pivotal sites enrolled. And for the moment, this is with any commercially available stents. There is some work being performed with some of these companies to try to develop sort of short stents and short balloons because this is, again, performed through direct cervical access. You don't need those long stent lengths as if you're going from a transfemoral approach. So I think in summary, we know that carotid angioplasty and stenting, although not as good as carotid endarterectomy, at least in most circumstances, with proximal occlusion and flow reversal, I think is safe and feasible, and I would argue has the potential to be comparable to what we see in terms of the acute results for carotid endarterectomy. It does. We do have a low rate of MI and cranial nerve injury. And there is some improvements compared to CEA, we think, from that standpoint, particularly since this can be performed under local anesthetic. There's a low rate of stroke and death, and we know that the new incidence of diffusion-weighted MR lesions is comparable to that from what we see of CEA. One of the things we're very much trying to do is encourage sites to start accumulating that data. That is not one of our current endpoints in the trial, but I'm trying to push pretty strongly for us to start tracking that data as well, because I think that will be important to know. And hopefully this large multi-center experience based here in the U.S. will give us some very important information going forward. Thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.